Welcome to episode 326 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with...
Andrew Swafford.
It's just us again.
That's all.
I don't know, guys. You know, I guess we hate Iran. Is that... we're going to get political? What are we going to do?
We're also recording this podcast in person because Zach has willingly, through no pressure of my own, decided to come to COVID Central, which is Knox County, Tennessee. And he works at home, so I'm not undergoing any risk, but he's undergoing a risk by being here with me because I'm a teacher. So
anyway.
If Zach dies in the next month or so, this podcast is why.
Well, yeah, we had a good run. Well, this episode, we got some movies that we saw this week in part one. In part two, we'll be continuing our Abbas Kiarostami series with 2002's 10.
We're going to have a fun little themed recording for that, too. I don't know if we should give it away now.
We're not going to give it away. We want people to listen to it and show and feign just a bit of interest in cinema that doesn't come from America.
Show some goddamn respect.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, all right, whatever. Let's go into movies that we saw this week. Andrew, I'm going to lead it off with you. You had a couple that you wanted to talk about.
Should we start with a movie that people know, or should we start with movies from far-flung places that people may or may not care about?
Well, let's not think of the people. Let's just do what you want to do.
Okay, let's start. Let's make good on our plea for people to care about movies from other places. Let's talk about some movies from other places. Firstly, I want to talk about a new short film by the one, the only, A Pitch Pong vs. Ethical, slow cinema pioneer, not pioneer, maybe pioneer, aficionado.
He's definitely like Thai film, like,
yeah.
Pioneer.
Important dude.
People.
Virtuosic slow cinema.
They look at him when, you know, like a section of the world, they go, like that guy.
That guy. That's the country of Pitcher Pong where Sethicle's from.
Yeah.
Anyways, he put out a short film on YouTube, I think. I think this is how this movie got distributed. It's called October Rumbles. It came out in the last week of October, October 29th. And it's a quarantine film. It consists of mostly one shot. But there is another shot that is sort of dissolved in over it as like a transparency. But it's a shot of what looks like a front porch. We're sitting on a Pitcher Pong vs. Ethical's front porch, and we're seeing this giant, I don't know if it's a curtain or a movie screen. It's kind of the shape of a movie screen, but it could also just be a curtain. And it's kind of waving in the wind in front of us, which kind of reminds me of the curtain / movie screen that we saw in A Pitch Pong vs. Ethical's Blue, the short film that we saw at TIFF a couple years back. But instead of having like paintings on it and images on it, this is just like a black screen, which kind of makes me think it's a movie screen of some kind. Like we're looking at the back of a movie screen.
It'd be a strange curtain.
What?
It'd be like
a random wide black curtain. Yeah.
On your front porch,
yes. But it's you know, wafting, it's waving in the wind, and we're looking at it from kind of a weird angle, and it takes up almost the entire frame, and depending on where it is kind of being pushed by the wind, in some moments, it literally is taking up the entire frame, and you're just looking at blackness, so you get these like little peaks through the blackness to like this bright, vibrant, like Thai jungle behind him. And it's shot with a digital camera, I think. Really, really high contrast. And there's like a lot of digital artifacts. And, you know, it has like that rainbow sort of prismatic look to it whenever, you know, digital images look real glitchy. And in some of the moments where the screen is basically all black because of where the curtain has fallen, that's when he starts to kind of fade in another image, which is a shot of somebody walking through the jungle, like I think at night with a lantern of some kind. So there's some sort of like idea being suggested here by like looking at your like mundane space that you're holed up in quarantine, but maybe like going somewhere else in your mind. And it's really like moving and nice and like, just like Blue in a lot of his feature films, has like a great audio soundscape to it. It's very transportive. It's like 5 minutes long, not super demanding, even though you're not, nothing really happens in the short. You're just kind of like looking at this object and this landscape behind the object. But if you want to just kind of like go into a Pitchapong Resethical's world and enter into his like spiritual rhythm, as his movies tend to put you in, this is a nice little treat that he just kind of uploaded on YouTube and gave to everybody.
Isn't he doing a movie with Tilda Swinton?
He is doing a movie with Tilda Swinton. I don't know any details about that or if it's going to be in English or when it is coming out, but I think it's already shot. I don't know. You can let me know if you're
I'm doing a quick little Google thingy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see this.
What's it called?
Hans Memoria.
Hans Memoria. Yeah.
No, Hans. So it's Ghostly Memoria.
Hans Memoria.
Yeah, Memoria. Mm-hmm. His next project, shot and set in Colombia with Tilda Swinton. The film is a rumination on memory. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what to think about in a Pitchapong Resethical movie starring American actors.
Yeah, it seems strange.
Like, it's one thing for Claire Denis to make a Robert Pattinson movie or whatever.
They seem
Abbas Kiarostami to make like a French movie with Julia Binoche or something. But I can't imagine anybody from like the Hollywood sphere kind of entering into the world of a Pitchapong Resethical. It feels so closed off to me.
Well, at least it's Tilda Swinton, and it's not like, you know, here's a Pitchapong Resethical's new movie starring Bradley Cooper.
Yes, know? Distributed by A24.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Bradley Cooper and Lucas Hedges. A24 movie. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's that movie, October Rumbles. Go watch it on YouTube. It's cool. I also wanted to talk about another Abbas Kiarostami movie, and let me actually go close the door because we're getting some audio.
We have here. It's like a child in there. It's like a rowdy teenager.
Okay, so I think maybe Darren mentioned this on the podcast he was on when we did The Gleaners and I. Maybe he did. Maybe that was off mic. I forget. But Darren recommended another Kiarostami film called Homework.
Yeah,
that did not make it into the series, but is really good and really special, and I want to recommend people watch it. This movie came out in 1989, which was 2 years after Where's the Friend's House, which has been the highlight of the series for me so far.
Super good.
It's really great. And I think this was shot contemporaneously with Where's the Friend's House, because he's hanging around with a lot of Iranian school children, which, you know, I imagine could potentially be like the cast of those school scenes at the beginning and the end of mm-hmm. Where's the Friend's House, right? And he's asking them about similar topics that are brought up in Where's the Friend's House, namely, as the title suggests, their homework. He gets the impression that, or actually, there's kind of a backstory to this movie, which is that Abbas Kiarostami was having a hard time helping his son with his homework. And so he decided to ask other kids about it and ask other parents about it. And he sort of made a documentary about it. And it's a very simple documentary. In a way, it reminds me a little bit of the movie we're going to talk about in the second half, 10, where there's almost like a structural conceit to the movie. You know, in 10, we're getting 10 conversations that are each about 10 minutes long. And they're all shot basically the same way. And in this, we're getting like a dozen or more interviews. And they're all also shot exactly the same way. They're in the same location. It's like a small, dark room. And it's Kiarostami and a cameraman and maybe a producer or somebody sitting in a room talking to a young Iranian schoolboy and asking that kid about their homework. Like, what's hard for you about your homework? Do your parents help you with your homework? What do you do after your homework? What happens if you do poorly on your homework? And the movie also I guess he had a second camera in the room, too, that we don't really see, because it cuts back and forth between just like a dead-on shot of the boys looking right in their eye and the camera that's looking at the boys. So you're kind of getting, it's like a shot reverse shot, like you're getting the kid's perspective and you're getting, Kiarostami's perspective. And the shots to the camera, like where you're looking into the lens of a camera, are kind of like reminding you that like these boys are tailoring their answers for what they think they need to say because they're being recorded. It's like, I forget the like physics principle, but it's like the idea that like if you observe something, you are inherently affecting it, you're changing it. No, what is that called?
I don't know what the term is, but now when I was researching for 10, the actress who's the lead actress in it, she like talked about that, and she has this good quote that I'm just gonna spoil from
this.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But she says, when there's a camera in front of you and you're aware that you're being recorded, it means there is a play happening. Therefore, there's cinema.
Right.
When there's a camera in front of you but you're unaware of its recording, it is in that moment this camera becomes like a thief stealing your reality and records those moments that cinema avoids to show.
Yes.
Being aware and unaware, the camera's recording made 10, and I was completely aware of the camera's recording.
Incredible. Yeah, I love that quote. So that very much is the case here. And in a comical, at moments in a comical way, because like Kiarostami asks a couple of questions to like every single kid. And you see like overlap between their answers. And one of the questions is, what do you like more, homework or cartoons? And every kid says they like homework more than cartoons because they think that that's what they're supposed to say to this like adult man with a camera standing in front of them.
Yeah.
But it's also like a brutally sad movie too, because you very quickly come to the understanding that these kids, almost every single one of them, are just being like incessantly abused at home because of their poor performance in school. Mm-hmm. Like they feel overwhelmed by the amount of homework they have, so they either rush through it or they do badly on it because they don't understand it, or they don't do it at all and they go watch TV instead. And they get beaten. Kiarostami asks them, what is punishment? How would you define punishment? And they all say getting hit. And he asks them, well, what happens when you do poorly in your homework? What happens when you don't do your homework? And he says, I get punished. He also asks the kids about like, well, what about encouragement? How would you define encouragement? And a lot of kids don't have a definition of encouragement. They don't know what that would even look like in practice. He asked the children like, well, when you have a kid, what will you do? Will you encourage them? Will you punish them? And almost all of them say, I would punish my kids. I would hit them because that's what I've seen, right? Yeah. The parents are also almost all of them illiterate. So they kind of can't help the kids with the homework. There's sort of like a helplessness on both sides. Mm-hmm. Corporal punishment becomes sort of the solution you can reach for when you can't reach to any sort of intellectual solution. And so it's just like a really unpleasant sit for a lot of it to just kind of think about the reality that these children are living in or were living in the 1980s. But it's something that I think that teachers today don't really think enough about either, that like every time you assign something that is to be done at home, you are kind of inherently, you are affecting the kid's home life in ways that you may not be able to perceive. Because of course we don't have a way of knowing, or we don't have like a surefire way of knowing how good a kid's home situation is, or like how much time they have to do their homework, what other responsibilities they have, or whatever. And especially right now in the COVID era, where we have a lot of kids doing school virtually, I think a lot of teachers interpret that or they use that as, I don't want to say an excuse, but the way that they approach virtual schooling is just putting a lot of work on the internet for the kids to do. Like, we can't do this, this, and this in the classroom, so I need to find some way to approximate it online. And so I'm just going to create like all these digital hoops that kids have to jump through. And they're getting that in all of their classes. And what I've heard from students this year is their homework load is so much bigger than it has been in years past, even though we all should probably be assigning less things this year because of the added stress and anxiety of everything else happening in the world. And again, us not knowing what these kids' home lives are like when they're stuck at home literally all day. So that was just kind of what I was thinking about, like the current, like, real world implications of this movie while watching it. But yeah, it does also have like a really beautiful and kind of redemptive ending that I won't spoil.
It's a Kiarostami movie.
It's a Kiarostami movie, right? But I would recommend watching it. It's 86 minutes. It's on the I'm sure it's on the Criterion Channel, but it's also on the disc for Where's the Friend's House, if you have that, or if you have access to it at a library or something. Really, really cool, interesting, thought-provoking movie.
No, if you have Criterion Channel, it's in the they have the little grouping of the Coker trilogy.
Yeah,
and it confuses you at first because they have the three films and then they have Homework.
Yeah,
you're like, well, is this one of them? But
yes,
it's available there.
It feels like it's one of them. Maybe like a prologue to Where's the Friend's House?
That would ruin the whole trilogy thing, though.
It would. True. Well, he didn't say it. He said it wasn't a trilogy, right? Kiarostami was very anti-Coker trilogy.
Anti-trilogy. Did you want to talk about Borat?
Let's talk about Borat. I'm sure the Borat movie people want to talk about right now is the second Borat movie, subsequent movie film.
Yeah.
I have not watched that. Have you watched that?
No, I don't have much interest.
I don't.
It lost any power that it thought it had, you know, 2 weeks ago. So.
Right. I mean, the second Borat movie, at least the way that it was talked about, seemed to be pitched as like Borat saves America. Borat sways the election against the Trump administration and specifically Rudy Giuliani. Like, almost everything I heard about the second Borat movie was like, oh, we got Rudy Giuliani to consent to sex with this woman that didn't actually want to have sex with him, and then we stopped it at the last moment. And like,
you got him, guys.
You got him, Rudy Giuliani. He's horny, you know? Like, you really got him there. I know, like, they said in the movie that, like, she was underage. They only said she was underage after he consented to have sex with her. And also, she wasn't actually underage either. So, like, again, Rudy Giuliani, guilty for being horny. Send him to horny jail. Rudy Giuliani makes a fool of himself every time he goes on TV without Borat's help.
Yeah, he doesn't need Borat's help.
He did this today. The day we're recording this was the day that he, like, had a hair meltdown while trying to make the case that voter fraud happened, but he's not actually claiming voter fraud
happened. The dude is a walking comedy machine.
Yes.
He does not need Sacha Baron Cohen. If anything, Sacha Baron Cohen needed him.
Maybe, yeah.
That's the other way around.
Would there be demand for another Borat movie if it was not like all tied up in Trump administration nonsense? We really want to like watch the train wreck that is the Trump administration in kind of a sick way. But yeah, everybody talking about Borat made me kind of realize that, oh, the first Borat was sort of a cultural touchstone from my youth that I never experienced. So I was too young for it, but I remember it being this big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and watched the first Borat movie. And it's interesting. There's good things about it. There's bad things about it. It's satire, which I think is a thing that people, at least the people that I was in circles of, didn't get back when it came out in 2006. Like, as a young kid, I mean, I guess I was 14 when this movie came out. As a 14-year-old, the cultural osmosis that I kind of absorbed about Borat was that he had a funny voice and he said, "My wife a lot."
My wife.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all you need.
That's all you need. And he wore, like, the weird, like, big thong swimsuit thing, right? And like, that's ignoring most of the movie. Like, most of the movie is like, the reason he talks in a funny voice is, like, he's putting on this caricature of, like, the quote-unquote backwards foreigner who comes from a country where it's, like, very patriarchal and very homophobic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the gag is, let's send this backwards foreigner to America and see how many Americans we can get to agree with him about social issues, cultural issues. And it turns out that's not very hard. Like, that's not very hard to get people to agree with the, like, stereotype of, like, the most horrendous regressive ideas in the world, right? And like that's where a lot of the power of the film comes from. Like there's a scene where he says to this guy at a rodeo, you know, in my country, when we find somebody who's gay, we like put them in prison and end their life. And the guy's like, well, we're trying to do that here in America too. There's another scene very close to that in the runtime when he finds a way to sing the national anthem at this rodeo. And he like is kind of doing this call and response thing with the crowd saying like, I support the troops in Iraq, and everybody claps. And he's like, America is the greatest country in the world, and everybody claps. And then he says like, I can't wait for George Bush to drink the blood of every Iraqi woman and child, and everybody claps. And like that, it's a good reminder that the Trump administration did not really start this like crazed, frenzied, hateful, like dark spirit in America. He definitely, like, to borrow Marianne Williamson's term, he like unleashed a dark psychic energy onto like the entire country, but the dark psychic energy was already there in certain pockets of the country, and that's kind of what Borat explores. Another fun one, by the way, is he gets on a bus with a bunch of frat boys, and unprompted, the frat boys talk about how they wish slavery was still a thing in America. Like, it's really aggressive, and I guess, and I really like this idea as satire, even though, like, the concept of, like, creating a stereotypical backwards foreigner for a country that actually exists, Kazakhstan, is kind of cringe. But where it really breaks down, I think, and where I think this is the reason why the cultural memory of this movie is just guy with a funny voice saying my wife, is that the way this movie is edited, and certain scenes that are placed in it really play up the like juvenile, scatological, like dumb quality to this that people really picked up on. You know, it garnered the same kind of following that like the Jackass movies did in the 2000s, where, you know, now people look back and they try to interpret it through this critical lens and try to, it's all smart, blah, blah, blah. But like,
it's very rude to do that but internationally.
But like, the people who were watching this shit when it came out were just mostly watching it for dumb reasons, right? And Borat has a lot of that shit. Like, it has some really wacky needle drops in it that like really plays up the just like silly, goofy aspect of everything. There's like a really long extended like nude fight scene where the joke is that Borat looks like he's having gay sex with this fat guy, but he's not. He's actually fighting him. And like, I can just see, you know, 14-year-old Andrew's friends watching this in 2006 and only laughing at, look at the dumb foreigner, look at the gay people, etc. When like the satire is supposed to be the opposite of that, right? So I think this is a moment where form and content are at odds with each other, like I talked about in my video essay last year. I know I'm probably the only person who wants this, but I want the like cinema verite version of Borat, where it's like very stone-faced and very quiet and like fly on the wall style, and doesn't really revel in the goofiness of Sacha Baron Cohen's performance, but just kind of observes how other people bounce off of him. There would be a lot less like immediate pleasure in watching it for the average viewer, but I think the satire would be a million times stronger, because I know I can see what he wants to do here, and I think I can see him failing in specific ways. Have you seen this movie? What did you see it back in 2006?
I haven't seen it forever.
Okay.
I do know, like, just kind of talking about the direction, it's directed by Larry Charles, who, he's known for, he's done a number of Sacha Baron Cohen's movies.
He did Bruno, which I would also like to see.
Yeah, he's done Bruno and The Dictator. He's done a lot of Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld.
Yeah.
That's kind of where he cut his teeth. He also did Religious, the Bill Meyer movie, if you just hate yourself and want to watch something. But yeah, so I guess Not that Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm are like trying to, you know, like wire into like juvenile antics, but like especially Curb Your Enthusiasm is about like you have these moments that are outlined but largely improvised,
right,
that you're trying to kind of interpret from there.
Right.
I think
Curb Your Enthusiasm has kind of like a cinema verite style to it, a little bit.
It's much more clear. That's what I was gonna say. Clearly, with Borat, he's you know
hamming it up a little bit.
There's a lot more going on than with Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's more restrained to a degree compared to a giant. I feel like you probably get a little ahead of yourself when you're at a giant rodeo and you're just, you know,
yeah,
that all that stuff's happening.
Right.
You're kind of like, whoa, there's a lot to go from.
Right.
So
yeah, those are my movies this week. I would strongly recommend the Kiarostami and the Pitch Pong movie. Borat, it's a compromised vision, I guess. Zach, what do
you
got?
If you want to go back to the, you know, Bush era.
Yes.
There you go. Real quickly, I wanted to note, I know Michael talked about it last week, but the new Don Hertzfeldt World of Tomorrow movie is out, and so I took that opportunity to rewatch the first two, which I realized I don't think I had seen the second one.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I was like watching the
second one. I found the second one hard to watch. Like, it was rough. Emotionally.
Oh, emotionally. Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah, the second one was really good, but I was like, I don't think I remember watching this. Anyway, great. The first two are really good. The third one I didn't have that immediate reaction that I had with like the other ones.
Yeah.
So this one, I think, and Michael talked about it a lot last week, and I would recommend going and listening back to him talk about that. But this one does not deal with the Emily Prime character as much. It's about the David character who we meet kind of briefly in the first movie, and like Michael described it, it's much more like science fiction focused than the ones prior to this. It's very much like working in kind of a sci-fi realm. That while the other ones are more, there's some sci-fi, there's some avant-garde, there's just some kind of experimentation to it.
I love Don Hertzfeldt's little avant-garde flourishes.
Yeah, and so you have that in this one, but it all, like in terms of the narrative, like then you think of the narrative of like the first two, it's kind of going into these like, you know, I think these kind of more spiritual, larger places. And this one, it kind of touches on that, but it also has much more of like a straightforward, like science fiction plot of like you. There's literally like a you have to go and kill these clones type situation going on where you're just like, oh, okay. So I liked it. I would recommend. It's like $7 or $8. You can get it on Vimeo. You're giving it straight to Don Hertzfeldt, so I don't, you know, I'm like, whatever. But if you have not seen these movies, it's a good chance to go see them.
You know, a thing that I was kind of hoping for that it seems like it's not going to happen was It's Such a Beautiful Day came out as three installments, and then he released it as a feature. And I was hoping that this would be the last act of the World of Tomorrow feature. But it seems like that's not the case, that this is just another chapter of which there will be many more.
Yeah, I think there'll be many more, because this does not feel like it has a firm ending. It feels like it kind of ends and there'll be a chapter four.
Right.
So, again, I would recommend checking those out if you can. The other one I wanted to talk about was I rewatched it. It was a nice. Can I just say that probably this movie is the easiest 3.5-hour movie you'll ever watch?
Oh, I'm intrigued.
It moves so quickly.
Okay.
It's just Seven Samurai. I mean, it's.
You know, that was not my experience with it. Really? I haven't seen it since probably 2013, 2014, but I remember being kind of bored by Seven Samurai.
Nah, it moves around. It moves a lot. 2013 Andrew is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, 2013 Andrew had no attention span whatsoever.
Just established that 2013 Andrew was going the Borat with his friends.
No, I wasn't. I literally did not. Go on.
So Seven Samurai, I rewatched this. I'd watched it a couple years ago, and I rewatched it because I just finished the video game Ghost of Tsushima, which I might get into more in a written essay. We'll see how that
would be cool.
We'll see how the weekend plays out. But this one, I feel like, is probably the most... It's the most well-known of Kurosawa's movies. It's the one, I think, that a lot of people kind of tag. I mean, it inspired The Magnificent Seven.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Assemble the Team movie.
Yeah. I saw a Letterboxd review, which was like, the Avengers thinks it's this movie. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
It does.
It's almost like the MCU thinks it's this movie. Like, that's, I know, true. 3.5 hours is long, but it's shorter than like 8 movies.
It gets to the point in 3.5 hours. It gets you through a narrative. You feel like you know everybody. It's, you don't need like 6 movies and like a fat Thor to kind of get through things. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, yeah. No, it's true. But basic story, you have these villagers, these farmers who are, they keep having their crops and everything stolen by these bandits. And so the bandits say that they're going to come back once the crops have kind of, you know, come to fold again. And so they, before that happens, they decide to go and try to find a samurai, or at least multiple samurai, to come and defend the village and kill these bandits. Mm-hmm. And so the first one they find is Kurosawa stalwart Takashi Shimura, who he kind of is the linchpin. He helps find a lot of the other samurai, including he didn't really find Toshiro Mifune's samurai. He just kind of wanders around and just follows them home. He has such a strange performance in this. Whenever you think of like, you think of like his performance in something like Yojimbo or Hidden Fortress or what's the Shakespeare?
Rashomon?
No. Oh, Rashomon.
Throne of Blood. Wrong.
Throne of Blood, yeah. Where he's at least in like Throne of Blood and Yojimbo, and that there's a little bit more like, he has a little bit more pedigree to him.
His swap.
He has the swagger to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In this one, he's just a freaking weirdo goofball. It's kind
of
fun.
Well, that's kind of his role in Rashomon, but of course he's like an unhinged sort of like Joker character in that movie.
He's less like, he's a little bit less like that. He's more just like, he just has an interesting performance in this one. But yeah, so you have these 7 samurai who come to the village. So the first probably hour and a half or so of the movie is them getting the team together, you know, assembling the team, doing a little training, and then you have a brief intermission, and then the last hour and a half or so of the movie is literally the battle with the bandits. And it's not like one just like, this is just happening all at once. It kind of has like these waves of stuff, which allows for, it's kind of nice because you get some action and then you have a kind of a quieter moment for some characterization and then you can go back. And so this one, I don't think this is not my favorite Kurosawa. I mean, I like it a lot. I like Yojimbo because it's much more like streamlined. It's much more, you know, it works within its little 2-hour window in such an effective way, in such a pragmatic way that this one, I mean, it does have moments where it's just kind of there are some really like just thinking about this time, like there's moments in the first hour and a half of this where you're just kind of, I'm like, are we supposed to be cutting now? Or like, I mean, there's like this one part where you have Takashi Shimura's character, he's walking down this road, and then you have Toshiro Mifune's character like circling him, and then you have the farmers who are like 12 paces behind him, and Takashi Shimura does not know that all of these people are around him, and he's just kind of like walking down the road, and we're watching this scene with no music, and it's just quiet. He's like walking, and Toshiro Mifune's like over there kind of like, you know, peacocking and doing weird stuff. And these farmers are like huddled behind him, and they follow him from one town to the next town. And I'm like, why are we watching this? Like, it's such a strange sequence. But he also, like, he just has like these really elongated, quiet, weird moments that kind of by the end of the movie, you realize why he has those, because they, like, you have this long sequence early in the movie in the barn where Toshiro Mifune's character is drunk and is like stumbling around and they're all messing with him and they're like kind of making him fall and stuff. And it goes on for like 15 minutes and you're just like, why are we watching this for 15 minutes?
Yeah.
But it does, you know, develop some characterization about who he is and kind of where he came from that pays off, you know, later in the film when we get to kind of know him a little bit more and we're engaged more in like the, you know, the struggle between the townspeople and the bandits. And so, I don't know. I think this one, you know, when you're thinking about like the team up movie, it's one of those, it's kind of, I mean, it is perfect in that, you know, we have to get this team together. I like the problem solving of it because it's just like, you got the team together. You got, these are the seven folks you got.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get to the town and you have all of these sequences where they're like, all right, so we got to guard the north, the south, and the east, the west, north, you know, and then they go through like, this is what this section has.
Yeah.
It has like a riverbed. And like, there's all this like strategizing, but it's like, there's something really satisfying about you're sitting there listening to these characters work through the strategy,
right,
almost in like a problem solving kind
who's
of
gonna
way.
Who's going to go where? Who's gonna
yeah,
go
and like, you're like, okay, so his character's going to go here. He's going to go. You're going to have, because you know, you don't even have the samurai. You also have these side
yeah.
characters with the farmers who you kind of get to know. And so, you know, the farmer's going to, you have the one farmer that Shira Mifune's character kind of
yeah.
loves to make fun of, who's going to go with him. You have these, so you have all these, various stories that are all kind of circling around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of, you know, thinking, as we alluded, you alluded to at the top, that Marvel kind of wants to be this movie, but on a grander scale. There's something really impressive that, even though, that's why I say it's a breezy 3.5 hours, because
mm-hmm.
you, one, don't think about the runtime. I think I checked the runtime at 2.5, just to be like,
okay,
where are we? But for the most part, you get sucked into, okay, you're trying to, all right, so these guys are doing this, these guys are doing that. You're getting into like the whole, you know, the logistics of the entire situation.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like it's something that I think a lot of movies of similar ilk that come out today, you know, going back to, it has these like quiet, why are these
mm-hmm.
in this movie moments, but they're, it's because he's like, you're going to have these moments that in the moment you're going, why am I sitting here watching Toshirô Mifune's character
right.
stumble around this barn drunk while they all kind of laugh at him? But later on in the film, when he has this breakdown talking about how he was a farmer growing up and he recognizes in that these samurai don't understand the impact that they have when they
mm-hmm.
go pillaging, pillaging, rampaging through villages, fighting crusades and being the hero, that whenever they do that, it leaves a farm, you know, barren and without their crops, and they, you know, are coming through raping their women and stealing their food and all that kind of stuff. And so it's like you have these quiet moments that Kurosawa, because he's a good director, is able to like weave
yeah.
into it in a way that by the end of that time you almost miss, oh, I kind of almost want to go back, and I miss those moments where
right.
we were just kind of goofing off in the barn. Now we're having to watch this character that we've been watching for this entire movie die
right.
real quickly in this moment, and there's like an impact to it, you know. It's so
you mentioned there not being a lot of modern movies that are really like this in terms of the spirit of it. Have you seen Takashi Miike's 13 Assassins?
No.
You should watch 13 Assassins. It's
okay.
Very similar to Seven Samurai. It's 2.5 hours instead of 3.5 hours. It stars Koji Yakusho, who you might know from like Cure or Memoirs of a Geisha.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically the Seven Samurai plot of like, we got to get the 13 people together because there's like an evil lord that we have to take down or whatever. And then there's a big showdown that takes like the last 30, 40 minutes of the film. But it's Takashi Miike, so it's like fucking brutal the entire time.
Yeah.
It's a really, really good movie.
Yeah.
Would recommend if you're on a samurai kick right now.
Well, it's not just samurai. I think that I like the action movies that kind of understand. I think the other great example, I think, of this outside of Seven Samurai is Dawn of the Dead.
Wait, the
second
Romero?
One. Romero, the second
okay,
one.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
When they're in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic problem-solving,
yes.
like, team
yeah, yeah, yeah.
action movie. Because it's a lot of moments where you're like, okay, this exit over here is
right.
we need to figure out something for the... And, like, I think that's what big blockbuster movies need to, they need to, we got to find some, we got to find some directors and some writers who understand like that just kind of tactileness of like the audience wants to kind of be engaged in the process.
Right.
I mean, ironically enough, a good example that's recent is something like Fast Five, the Fast and Furious movie, because it's very good at like, we got to get the team together and this, we have to get this team person because of this, we need this specific skill set. I don't know. Marvel's, the Avengers, it's not effective because you're getting excited because these people show up because of their names and who they represent. It's not because, oh, we need a, we need somebody to hack into the system, so we got to get this guy, and we need somebody to do. Mission Impossible's pretty good at it also, but.
But it's mostly the Tom Cruise show.
It is the Tom Cruise show. But yeah, I would recommend Seven Samurai. It's a good, you know, Sunday matinee if you're just looking to like sit inside all day.
Yeah, have you heard of this movie, Seven Samurai? You should watch it.
You should watch it. It's pretty good. We'll get 2013 Andrew to watch it with us once he's finished, you know, saying my wife in the corner or whatever.
Yes.
All right, we're gonna go get in the car. So we'll be back after this break. Hello, Cinematary. This is Zach, your host, and I'm going to use this midpoint in this week's episode to let you know a little bit about what's happening on both the website and the podcast. So first off, I know for a very long time we asked you not to give us any money. Well, things have changed. We want that money. I'm just kidding. We just want like $5 a month for the rest of your life. But we're doing a Patreon, and I promise this is all in good fun. Patreon.com/cinematary. I'm sure you've heard us mention it at the end of the episode. We are doing this in order to pay for our writing that is happening on the website. We have a wonderful breadth of writers who are all giving a lot of time and effort to come up with reviews and share their thoughts on the website. And so we wanted to just give back to them in that way. And so that is why we created our Patreon page. So again, for $5 a month, you can get exclusive content from the staff. Right now we have our hit series Film Theory and Chill, which takes a piece of film theory each month and then deconstructs it in a way that makes it a little bit more accessible. And then we end that episode usually with just us rambling about whatever is on our mind at that period of time. It's for some people, I guess. But you can find that on patreon.com/cinematary. Please consider, you know, making that donation each month just to help show these writers your appreciation for what they do. Another easy way to kind of keep up with what's happening on Cinematary is signing up for our free newsletter. So if you missed an episode, if you weren't paying attention to social media and you missed maybe a review or something, or a video essay or something that we posted, this is an easy way to keep up with all of that. So each Sunday we send out a note. It goes straight to your inbox. It gives you the latest podcast episodes, you know, what's happening on the Patreon page, and the last two reviews that are on cinematary.com. This is a great way to keep up with what's happening, and it's a nice way if you forget to go, oh, hey, I'm not, you know, just chilling out on a Sunday. I'm having some coffee, doing Sunday things. Here, I'm going to check out what Andrew wrote about something, or what Nathan wrote about something. Just, you know, we got that stuff going. So you can find that on the website, cinematary.com. You can sign up for the newsletter. Again, it's free. And finally, the easiest way to support this show is to go on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and review. You know, this is just how the algorithms work. I know every show asks you to do this, but honestly, if you could take, 30 seconds to a minute and do this, it would greatly, you know, help us. I mean, this helps us just as much as, you know, signing up for the Patreon or letting people know on social media that you listen to Cinematary and you enjoy it. All of that stuff is very helpful, so give us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to the podcast, and, you know, share it on social media. Let people know that Cinematary is around. So again, consider donating to Patreon. That's patreon.com/cinematary. Sign up for the free newsletter and then give us a rating and review on your podcaster app. Well, that is way too much of me talking. You're about to hear more of me talking, so I apologize in advance, but thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show.
sleeping as we fly. I'm holding very tight.
And we're back with part two of episode 326 of Cinematary. We are in Andrew's car. So we decided to go real high concept with this. I felt bad because Michael had a wonderful idea with close-up of, like, you know, mistaken identity. And, like, he was going to pretend to be Andrew for the episode. But we didn't do that. So we decided... Right? Yeah. And so I was like, we'll go high concept with this one. We're going to drive around in a car where this movie, 2002, that Abbas Kiarostami directed... Is taking place in a car where this... Well, I'm just going to read my notes.
Three of the four movies we've watched in the series so far
have a lot of cars.
Very prominent car conversations. So here we are, just as Kiarostami intended. We even got the windows cracked a little bit so you can hear some more road noise. We hope you enjoy the vibes of this episode.
As we pass by the Pilot gas station. Just as he intended. All right, so 10... it's about a female taxi driver. Her name, the actress is Mania Akbari, and she ferries 10 different passengers around Tehran.
Well, not 10 different passengers.
Well, 10 different.
There are 10 vignettes.
There's 10 vignettes. Yeah. It has, there's her son, there's some friends of hers, there's an old woman, there's some prostitutes. So you have a variety of stories. Mm-hmm. But many of the cast were untrained as actors, and the film has a kind of improv element. They recorded it, or actually they like had, it was kind of like we were talking about Curb Your Enthusiasm in the first part.
Yeah.
They had like an outline, but she said that they just kind of, they improvised most of it. It was just like have a conversation.
The characters knew who their characters were, but it was kind of like a role-playing
game. Well, they were based
game.
Off of, they kind of, they were very much based off of themselves. Yeah, so... But they had two...
Wait, is that kid acting, or is that just actually how he is?
No, I think he's just a shit. So the film, or the, yeah, it was recorded on two digital cameras. You had one attached to each side of the moving car, showing the driver and the passenger, respectively. This was... I couldn't get firm confirmation on this, but I saw somewhere that this was the first of Kiarostami's films to be banned in Iran because of its, because it covers prostitution, which is illegal.
Yeah.
So, something to think about. But I found this really interesting interview that I used one of the quotes in the first part, but Mania Akbari was talking about the film in 2016, saying, I don't know what a true work of cinema is. 10 is the product of reality with a cinematic view. Unlike Kiarostami's other films in which a director attempts to say, this is a film, but it is reality, 10 is the complete opposite. It is a reality about which a director attempts to say, this is a film. It is all the secrets of a work embedded in this point that makes 10 outstanding. And she was talking about his legacy, Kiarostami's legacy, because this was after... I think it was close to when he had died. She said, I think Abbas Kiarostami depicted a new meaning to the secrets and mysteries of life and created a different language of simplicity. The simplicity wasn't raised out of mediocrity, but rather the kind of simplicity one achieves after passing through 1,000 labyrinths. And this was just kind of interesting. I mentioned this before we got in the car, but Roger Ebert, not a fan of Abbas Kiarostami. He didn't, like, hate him, but
it's shocking to me that someone as, like, humanistically focused as Roger Ebert would not like Abbas Kiarostami.
Yeah, I know. But he said, I am unable to grasp the greatness of Abbas Kiarostami. His critical reputation is unmatched. His Taste of Cherry won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and The Wind Will Carry Us won the Golden Lion at Venice, and yet his films, for example, his latest work, 10, are meant not so much to be watched as to be written about. His reviews make his points better than he does.
He said this shit about Chungking Express, too. He said that, like, Chungking Express isn't a movie that you love because of what it says about life, but what it knows about movies or something like that, which is just a total head-ass
It's a little dismissive.
Yeah.
So what did you think of 10?
I liked it. Not my favorite of the Kiarostami films I've seen. I think it ranks below Where is the Friend's House, Taste of Cherry, Certified Copy for me. But I did enjoy it. I guess the main emotion that I felt while watching it, though, was rage or anger directed specifically at the young child actor, the boy.
Fuck that kid, man.
Yeah, like, it's so wild to me that, like, Kiar Stami, who created, like, maybe the greatest child character of all time with Where is the Friend's House, and then also created this, like, really tender documentary about, like, young boys being abused with homework, would just then turn around and make a fucking Men Are Trash movie that is, like, laser focused at this child and how he has been groomed to be a toxic asshole by his culture and by his dad.
Yeah.
I never want to wish physical harm upon a child, but there were moments in this movie where I was kind of wishing that she would just, like, Lady Bird style, like, kick him out of the moving car.
Well, he doesn't even, like, go, all right, let's show some, like, sympathy for this kid. Let's go in this moment.
This kid is incessantly horrible from beginning to end.
We literally kick off with, like, vinegar in the face.
Yes. And, like, the kid becomes, like, non-verbal in his, like, attempts to be shitty to his mom. Like, the main thing is that his mom divorced his dad and has remarried somebody else, and so it's, like, a classic you're not my dad kind of thing, but also, like, blaming the mom, kind of, like, implying that she's a whore or something like that for being with somebody who's not her dad. So he's just, like, constantly yelling at her about that and about a million other things. But at times, I mean, she tries to talk back to him, and it seems like she's really making an effort to raise her child in a really humanistic, empathetic way where nothing's really off limits, that they can kind of talk about anything, and she wants to kind of meet her son as an equal.
Yeah.
But, like, that doesn't work when he can't behave in, like, anything approaching a mature way. Like, she tries to reason with him, and at points he just, like, screams and flails and makes noises because he just, like, can't logically process the things that she's saying. So it's just, like, really infuriating, like, to hear her kind of, like, talk to a wall that's, like, screaming back at her.
Yeah, that's the most frustrating part is you can see her trying to, like, break through something with him.
Yeah.
And they're just, you're constantly unable to, like, he's just so walled up about it. And I don't know, I got to the point also where I was just like, lady, listen, it's cut. Like, just, you're going to have to give this one up. You just, you know.
Let the dad raise him and let the dad just turn him into an awful person. The damage is done.
The damage is done. But you also have, like, these, you know, this one actually took me a little... I had a little trouble. Well, one, you start with this shit kid.
It's the first vignette. And he comes back, like, three times, I think. He's three or four of the 10 vignettes.
Yeah. So, it's tough. So, to me, I struggled a little bit with it just because you kind of have to get... It's one of those movies. You have to get on its wavelength. Yeah. It's going to do what it's going to do, and you can either get on board with it or you're not going to get on board with it.
Right.
And to me, the one I got most on board with that I found to be actually really moving was... It's later in the film, and it's, I think it's a friend of hers, because she's been in one of the vignettes prior.
Is it the woman who shaved her head?
The woman who shaved her head.
Oh, my God. It was beautiful. Yeah.
It was such a wonderful little story. And so you have this woman, and she in the first vignette, she's talking about this relationship she's in, and clearly it's something that she just, it's kind of toxic. She just needs to get out of it, but she's still holding on to it because she feels like some, you know, she feels indebted to this man and like she needs to be in it.
When I said earlier it's Kiar Stami's Men Are Trash movie, like I mean that, you know, we get the kid who kind of dominates the runtime of the film because he's in there so many times, but every other passenger in this car is a woman, and most of them share something about negative experiences they've had with men.
Yeah.
Either a boyfriend who's broken up with them, or someone that they're still with but is treating them poorly. Really the only character who has the most, like, I don't know, positive relationship with men is the prostitute character, which is kind of an interesting thing. We can get back to that later. You were saying about the woman who shaved her head.
But yeah, she has this, and so you have this really tender moment, so you've had this onslaught of this, you know, demon child screaming at his mom. And then you have this really tender moment where you have this, you know, clearly they have, you know, some sort of friendship. You know, I don't know how close they are. But she has this, you know, she's talking about how she kind of just needs to get, clearly this relationship is not going where it needs to be going, and she needs to get, you know, get out of it. And the driver makes this comment, like, you wear your hijab kind of tight, you know, you wear this,
which is true about all of the women who share the car with her. The woman who drives, she kind of, you can kind of see her neck and her jawline and a lot of her hair for most of the movie, even though she is wearing a hijab. And that was the thing that I noticed pretty early on, is like everybody else she drives with is like wearing it much more conservatively, much more tightly, making sure that you can't see their hairline or anything like that.
Yeah, and so she makes that comment, and so she's like, you know, just like let it, you know, let it loose a little bit, like just, you know, so it's not, she doesn't say suffocating you, but like just kind of open it up a little bit, open yourself. And so when she does that, you can tell that her hair has been shaved. And so she goes, did you shave your hair? And she's like, no, take it off. Let me see. And so then you have this like moment where she takes her hijab completely off.
Very vulnerable moment.
She, you know, she's showing like this kind of completely shaved head, and she's talking about how, I'm not really sure about it. And the driver's like, no, it's beautiful. You look so nice.
Yeah.
And you just have this really like, this really tender, really vulnerable, really human moment between these two women after just this onslaught of just negativity.
But also, like, that's vignette 9.
Yeah, exactly.
And vignette 10 is you're back with the fucking kid again. It feels like the Kiarostami ending is to end with that.
Yeah.
With 9. But it does have this, like, black pill ending where we're back with the kid, and this time... He says something that he says earlier in the film where he, like, as soon as he gets in the car, he demands to be taken to his grandmother's house so the grandmother can fix him some food, because apparently he doesn't like the food that his mom cooks him because he's an ungrateful shit, right? But in the 10th vignette, he gets in the car and he says, take me to grandma's house. I need her to cook me food. And the woman just says, okay. Like, she's kind of...
I don't have time for this shit anymore.
Right. And I guess that's kind of what we were saying earlier, like, give up, lady. And she does give up in the last vignette. But, man, I do wonder how this film would play differently if the 9th vignette had actually been the ending.
Well, you also have... You have a lot of that where it's not necessarily just give up. It's more, like, why... A lot of the movie is, why are you exerting this amount of energy for this person? Because,
right.
Like, you think about it, you have this kid... You have the friend who's clearly putting too much energy into this relationship. Mm-hmm. But then you also, you know, you have the conversation with this other woman where the driver's literally like yelling at her like, no, just you don't need men. You don't need this person to make
right.
you happy. Just screw that guy. Like, get out of here.
I mean, I can imagine people older than us listening to this podcast and rolling their eyes at us and saying that, like, that's kind of the nature of parenting, right? Like, you are kind of talking to a wall a lot of the time. You can't just kind of give up on your kid when, like, you're putting forth way more effort than they are into maintaining your relationship or something like that. But damn, if it isn't hard to empathize with this boy in this movie.
Exactly. Well, I posed this question to Michael last week, but this seems to be like the epitome of the Kiarostami car movie. And so,
yeah,
like, when
yeah.
when we think about these 10 vignettes that he presents, I guess why does he feel like it needs to be in, you know, we don't have any other moments outside of the vehicle. It
right.
takes place completely in the vehicle from start to stop. So
right.
I mean, why do you feel like we have to mm-hmm. hash this, like, there's something about, like, the we're going from point A to point B. We have just dead air in between, and
right.
we need to fill it. And usually that gets filled with, you know, angst that we have for one another. I don't know,
yeah.
like, is that what he's kind of tapping into?
Well, I mean, I think that Michael... I don't think I could be able to make Michael's points from last week as eloquently as he made them. The idea that cars are kind of inherently alienating and isolating things... But they are also spaces where people are forced to spend time together and talk with one another.
Or podcast.
Or do a podcast with one another. Which, like, podcasts are kind of a way of forcing people to have long conversations too, which is nice. But I do think that in this movie, there's a little bit more of, like, a socio-political, cultural bent to it. I was reminded of Jafar Panahi's movie Taxi. Have you seen... Taxi?
No, but I'm aware of it.
It's really good.
He's kind of a disciple of Kiarostami.
Well, not only a disciple of Kiarostami, he was a former collaborator of Kiarostami. Yeah. I didn't mention it on the Coco Trilogy, but I think he was like the second unit director of the second movie, and maybe the third one too.
He was at least on Olive Trees. I saw his name.
Yeah, I remember him in Olive Trees. But yeah, like Jafar Panahi's Taxi feels like a riff or a spiritual sequel to 10.
Yeah,
we're going to roll the windows.
We're going to go on the highway now.
We're on the interstate. So
it's real safe.
For context, Jafar Panahi, if people don't know him, Iranian filmmaker who supposedly is kind of banned by the Iranian government for making films. So he has to find ways to covertly make films and then distribute them in a stealthy way. Like, the story goes that he has this movie called This Is Not a Film that he smuggled out of the country in a birthday cake, right? And so Taxi is a movie where he, at least in the world of the film, it's kind of hard to tell how much of it's fiction, how much of it's not, he takes the job of a taxi driver and just, like, sticks a camera in his taxi and just, like, talks to people. And in that film, you kind of get this really interesting snapshot of the many different facets of Iranian culture, and like the ways in which the Iranian government is kind of repressive and stuff like that. But so in 10, I feel like much more so than the other Kiarostami car movies, I'm kind of seeing the edges of mainstream Iranian like political culture and what people are and are not allowed to do in public in Iranian culture. And so in a way, like the woman who takes her hijab off, which is not a thing she could do if they're out on the street, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, the car kind of exists as, you know, it's an isolating space, it's an alienating space, but it's also a space of a certain amount of freedom because you are kind of closed off to the rest of the world. And, I mean, I guess there's the threat of, like, the authorities kind of looking through your windows or whatever. But, like, you're going so fast that, you know, it's hard for anybody to really police your speech or dress or behavior when you're in a car. It is sort of like your own, like, little sovereign space, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I think that, you know, it's interesting that he kind of... he has such beautiful images in his films that have like such rich depth of field. Like, I mean, I talked a little bit about in the Coker trilogy, you have these images of this Z-shaped hill that are just so, and then in Taste of Cherry, you have these kind of almost
really wide shots of the road.
Yeah. Wide helicopter shots that really puncture the landscape. But then he also has these, it's like he kind of, magnifies in on these moments where he kind of locks you in the car. We talked about it last week, but he kind of locks you in the car for these moments. And so while I didn't overly love this movie, it's what makes it interesting, because that's why I ask, why did he want to tell us these specific stories? Because we're locked in the car with these people. And so why are we locked in the car with these people, to kind of get this sense? And I think, I think overall it's that you have to suffer through this shitty kid and all of these kind of, you know, small vignettes, because you just kind of seen like what the basic invisible concessions and understandings that this woman has to kind of come to grips with as she is going around town, whether it's with her family, whether it's with her friends, or, you know, even with her, you know, patrons in the cab. Like, you have we mentioned the prostitutes, but you have like this sequence with prostitutes where they're talking about like the various acts and stuff that they're getting into, and they're kind of pressing her on stuff and asking,
they're challenging her worldview. I mean, it's kind of a pro sex work movie. It doesn't seem like Abbas Kiarostami is in skeptical of these women in the same way that the protagonist is skeptical of these women, because he kind of lets them win the argument talking about, and I don't love the idea that like all relationships are inherently transactional. That is one of the arguments that they make. Like, yeah. Well, you know, you think that you are in a free, non-financially, laden relationship with your husband, but like, you know, he bought you that necklace. What did he buy you that necklace for? Like, was there any exchange that happened there? But it does seem like, I don't know, the prostitute characters kind of have like a more acute understanding of human relationships than the main character does. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just kind of whether she takes anything from it or not, it's kind of like, it also just shows the nature of that position where she's presented with, like, that's a worldview that I don't think we would necessarily run into unless we were seeking out prostitutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that she just kind of probably just stumbled across, but at the very end of the day, it's not like that dominates the entire movie. It's just kind of like an anecdote within something that, she has this perspective now. Oh, this is a life for these people. I maybe disagree or agree with them. I don't know, but it's like I have the knowledge of this worldview now, mm-hmm. and I think that's kind of, especially throughout this movie, what Kiarostami's kind of interested in. These almost tokens seem like little perspectives, whether we agree with them or not, that we're coming across, that we just go, oh, interesting.
Yeah. And that's presenting it in like a mundane, humanizing way. You know, this is not an issues movie about like the role of women in Iran or about prostitution specifically, even though it kind of is that thing, but it only gets at it in the everyday, in the ordinary.
Right? Yeah. It gets at it in a way that it's more, it feels much more real. Like, that's why, you know, you think of that quote about like the reality and the cinematic, like this is reality that's presented in a cinematic view, because this is something that you could stumble across this conversation if you were like an Uber driver, or if you were, you know, in non-COVID times, like at some bar or something, like, and somebody just struck up a conversation with you. Like, this is something that you could absolutely run into. We could stop somewhere here in Knoxville and probably run into something like that. But I guess one film I was thinking about, just kind of to compare it with the director that we did prior to this, Agnes Varda, was this movie seemed to be Kiarostami's Gleaners and I, just with the kind of how he adapted digital technology. Like, I don't really know. I haven't seen anything that, you know, he was interested in digital to the way that Varda was, and we kind of talked about with Gleaners and I, but it seemed like there's a lot of this movie that feels like, look at what I can, like, I can capture these moments so freely. It's similar to Gleaners and I, where I can capture these moments so freely because I have this device that allows me to do that.
Small, so you can stick it up in the front of a car, as opposed to, like, the big rig that you need for the celluloid film shoot, right?
Yeah.
But also, a thing with, like, Simon Lang, who's another director who's, like, really interested in digital cinematography, is you're not limited to how much you can shoot, because you can just have, like, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes of storage on this thing. I was kind of expecting for the vignettes to each be, like, one shot, or maybe two shots back and forth or something. But there's a lot of cutting. You'll be watching the kid, and he'll be in the middle of a sentence or something, and it'll cut to, like, him finishing the sentence.
Yeah.
And I imagine they just kind of, like, drove around and talked for hours, and he just, like, let the camera roll, and then later, you know, condensed it into the most, like, thematically potent stuff.
Gotta imagine that editing.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Oh, look, he's yelling again. Oh, alright.
But to piggyback on your thing about, like, how interested is Kiarostami in digital, I don't really know, because I haven't seen... I've seen a lot of Kiarostami movies, but I haven't seen all the Kiarostami movies. I think most of the ones I've seen are shot on film. But the one that I'm thinking of is his last movie he made before his death, which is 24 Frames. And in that film, I'm almost positive it's digital. He just took these long digital takes of various windows and other sorts of frames, and also picture frames. He films some paintings, and then like goes into the. This is a movie that I was thinking about suggesting for the series because it's kind of interesting in like the artifice of it.
Yeah.
But he goes in and manipulates the digital images and makes them move in ways that they weren't actually moving when he was taking the shot. So like he has, oh, I forget the name of this painting that's like by the old, like, what are they called? Like the Danish masters or whatever. It's the painting of like all the people on like the snowy hillside, and you see like the village and like all the things that are happening, right? Mm-hmm. And he like animates them, and you can see them like actually walking around and such. And so it's a very different thing from this, but that he also kind of uses digital in this structural way too, where I was talking about this with Homework at the beginning of the podcast, where like. In a way, these movies kind of remind me of structural avant-garde cinema we talked about with Michael Snow, where, like, you kind of map out, like, a temporal schematic of what the film is going to be. Like, here's what this 10 minutes is going to be, here's what this 10 minutes is going to be, before you shoot it. And you kind of, like, you mold your film to fit that structure. Where here, like, in 24 frames, like, well, let's make a movie out of 24 moving frames. Here, let's make a movie out of 10 vignettes in a car. He also has a movie called 5 Dedicated to Ozu, which are 5 long shots of like landscapes and like beaches and stuff like that.
It's called Pillow Shots.
I've not seen that movie, but it seems of a piece with 10 and 24 frames in how it uses like duration and like film structure and time to kind of like capture a certain experience.
Yeah, and I think that that's something, you know, if we're going to compare the two, I think that that's where Kiarostami and Varda kind of intersect, is they have a lot of interest in the structure and the form as much as the narrative. You know, Varda will have something like Cleo from 5 to 7.
Yeah, which is almost in real time.
Yeah, which also is still dealing with, like, structure, even though it kind of has a much more straightforward narrative than some of the other things. And Kiarostami has, I mean, there's a clear structure in place to, like, Taste of Cherry. But they're also, they're interested in how can I work in that temporal space, in, like, around the film and play with the elements that make a movie.
Yeah.
In ways that is interesting. And I like that they kind of had this bridge between, you know, film and digital, where rather than kind of putting their arms together and going, I can't, you know, this isn't pure. It's like, oh, well, this is a new tool I can add to my toolbox. How can I, you know, better utilize this? And so stuff like 10 maybe is not your favorite thing of all time or your favorite thing by Kiarostami, but there's something, at least to me, that's impressive about it, just because it's kind of, I like these, you know, theory experiments, these thought experiments that these directors do.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't have anything to add to that.
I just was taken by that structure. That wasn't like that when I was in Knoxville.
Oh, the like little shopping center, the strip mall?
Yeah. That's different. Anyway. I got veered off course. That's the problem with the driving
the
podcast.
Car format. Like, we can just describe what we're driving by if you want. We just have a
no,
little
we,
bit of,
yeah,
like,
we got
scenic.
Some...
audio.
We're on this Cumberland, correct?
We're on Cumberland, yeah.
Cumberland, and there's some trees.
We're in the nice little bougie
area. Oh, we're in the bougie-ass area.
Between UTK and Bearden, where, like, there's literally, like, little colonial houses over to the side with, like, signs in front of them talking about the historic nature of the building or whatever. Yeah,
I mean, these people suck. Yeah, they're not listening to the podcast. We're fine.
They're not.
I'm trying to think if we missed any of the other vignettes. There was the.
I think we've talked about all the major ones.
We didn't talk. The older woman one really didn't have much of an impact on me.
I didn't really know what to do with that. I mean, other than the fact that it kind of circulates around the mausoleum as a setting, which they circle back to several times. there's moments where the protagonist talks about, I think it's a protagonist, maybe it's somebody else, talks about like how they didn't let me in the mausoleum today because I wasn't like veiled properly or whatever. And I was not really sure what to do with that. Like, why is the mausoleum such a central location in this movie?
Yeah. There's a lot of, this one it seemed like was dealing with a lot of traditions and practices, which we haven't seen as much in his movies. Like, there's been a, like, I can see why something like Close Up and Taste of Cherry and even the Coker trilogy to a degree plays well with Western audiences because there's... It's
very universal.
There's a translation to Westerners that's a little bit easier. This one is very ingrained, and that's probably why, if it's true, this was banned for a time in Iran, because it's very, not necessarily critical, but just like...
Political. It's more naturally political.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I think there's probably that element also of just like, why are you showing the Westerners are, you know, all of this stuff that we kind of just keep bottled in our own country that we just kind of deal with. I mean, there's a degree of that we have in America, but we're also so loud and boisterous constantly that everybody knows everything about us. Right. But it's almost like it's almost like a family, like, well, let's not bring the family stuff out into the open, you know? It feels like...
Well, that certainly seems to be the case with Jafar Panahi and his relationship to the Iranian government, right?
Yeah, so that's why I'm like, you know, I think that maybe it's one of those things where it's just like, let's not bring it out in the open. Any other thoughts on 10?
No, I mean, it's before we kind get of to the place we're going. It's an interesting, it feels like an experimental film in Kiarostami's catalog, much more so than some of the others we've talked about. Like almost, it's very conceptual in nature, more so than narrative really. And so this is definitely not what I would recommend to people as like their first Kiarostami film.
Oh God!
Like you should watch probably 3 or 4 at least of the bigger ones before you get to this. But it kind of shows him kind of thinking and working in a different mode that is interesting.
It's as we just described. It's much more academic almost. It's like if you're I think this is one to watch if you're interested in how a director can kind of, especially a contemporary director, can kind of play around with film form and structure in ways that are kind of, you know, whether it's effective or not. I think that's, it's more, if you're interested in kind of those concepts, then I would recommend this. But if you're, yeah, dude, we get it. Dude, the big boy over here. Whoa. Big old truck right there. Big boy.
No Trump flag on the back, though.
That's
he maybe took it down.
He took it. It's been a rough few weeks. It's one. The 10 is definitely a movie that I think I would not recommend unless you're just kind of you're either trying to be a completionist or you're more interested in the concepts and the academic level of it. But it still has its. I think it's one that, you know, at some point I might go revisit just for, you know, for some reason.
And it still does have that like you said, it's a Kiarostami movie, that kind of beautiful, transcendent, moving last couple sequences with the woman with her shaved head and stuff like that. So it's not like it's completely cerebral. There's emotion to this movie for sure, though a lot of that emotion is rage towards small children.
You know, it awakens things inside you that, you know, you're not expecting. All right, well, I believe this will complete this episode of Cinematary. I don't know if I think the card was... I haven't listened back to the audio, but we'll see how successful it was.
Yeah, I like this idea. I don't know how much it'll translate to non-Kiarostami episodes of the podcast, but, you know, keep it in our back pocket.
We should just... Well, I'm excited for next week with Certified Copy. I'm planning to...
change your identity
halfway through. we're gonna be changing our identity halfway through the episode. It's gonna be crazy.
Or you could change your opinion of the film halfway through, like the first half of part two. You could talk about it as if you hate it, and then you talk about it as if you love it.
I might do that. That's actually kind of fun. We'll play around with it. All right. Well, you can. Oh man, I don't have the patron sheet. Well, I'll try to name it off as best I can. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterbox at letterbox.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Head over to our Patreon channel. We got a nice film theory and chill on there. Patreon.com/cinematary. Thank you to our patrons. I can't name it off the top of my head.
Wait, here, let me help you out. Chad Newsom.
Harry Eskin.
Titus Arthur.
Cindy Roberts. Shout out to Cindy.
Listen to every episode.
Yeah, Cindy.
Christina Daughtry.
Cam.
Is Cam still a patron?
Yeah.
Cam should not still be a patron. He's on the podcast.
Don't tell him.
Who else? Kittiest of Kittens.
How do we forget Kittiest of Kittens? Hell yeah, Small World.
Hell yeah, Small World.
Ron Hayes.
Ron Hayes, of course.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Is that it? I haven't been counting.
I'm so sorry if we forgot somebody.
We love you.
We love you, though. We do. We just like Cindy because I just learned that she listened to all the episodes. We appreciate that.
Also, Cindy, I also like the Joker. Just want to let you know.
That's just in case. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening, and we'll be back next week. We got 2010's Certified Copy, which honestly is in my top three for Kiarostami movies.
It's such a good movie. Yeah, probably my number. Yeah, it's my number three, I think, behind Taste of Cherry and Where's the Friend's House. It's so good.
Yeah, it's great. All right, thanks, guys.